From the 4th to the 23rd of January, the Skoda Big Event is on. With huge offers like 0% APR and £2,000 towards your deposit on a brand new Skoda Octavia. Plus £500 worth of free fuel with every new car ordered. The Skoda Big Event. For your nearest retailer, check skoda.co.uk and think big. With Solutions Personal Contract Plan. 18 and over subject to status. Skoda Financial Services. T's and C's apply. Excludes SE Business and SE Technology.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to introduce the Chief Justice of the United States, John G. Roberts, Jr., who will administer the presidential oath of office. Everyone, please stand.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
Hello, my name is Gabriel Montoya, and this is The Undiscovered Country, a weekly exploration of the hidden territory, both inner and outer, of our country and ourselves. We will do this through interviews with activists and advocates of peace and positive change, by sharing personal stories and illuminating important events, and finally, through positive legal actions. Since November 8th, 2016, the date of this country's last presidential election, I've been ruminating on one of my favorite soliloquies from William Shakespeare's canon. This is from The Tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, Act 3, Scene 1. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. To die. To sleep no more. And by a sleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks the flesh is heir to? 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die. To sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye. There's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time? The oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin. Who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others we know not of. Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pitch and moment, with this regard, their currents turn awry, and lose the name of action. That speech is spoken by a man facing the toughest choice of his lifetime. To be king or not to be, to suffer in honorable silence, while Hamlet's uncle, the man who allegedly murdered his father, the king, and hastily married his mother, the queen, enjoys Hamlet's rightful place on Denmark's throne. Faced with that choice, to be or not to be, Hamlet is frozen by fear and thus loses the name of action. Right now, many frightened Americans face a similar fork in the roadmap of our country's history. Fortunately, United States citizens live in a democracy, malfunctioning though it is. We have legal actions we can take. We have ways of resisting that poor Hamlet, trapped in a monarchy, cannot fathom. And we'll need them all. Prince, David Bowie, Carrie Fisher, and too many more to name here. 2016 was the year our collective childhoods died. But maybe putting away our childish things was the message. 2017 opened with the deaths of legendary muckraker Wayne Barrett, and perhaps democracy in the United States as we know it. Perhaps Mr. Barrett's death, a day before the man he spent decades exposing as a liar, cheat, and menace to society, was inaugurated as the most illegitimate president of the United States since George W. Bush, is another message. It is time for all of us to pick up Mr. Barrett's torch and run with it. The reality of January 20th and beyond is that many of us face a myriad of to-be-or-not-to-bes as we, along with the rest of the world, enter into the undiscovered country of the next 4 to 8 years, maybe more. To be or not to be. To be just or unjust. To be kind or cruel. To be willing to explore why this man is in the highest office in the land, or deaf to our fellow citizens' needs and wants. To be citizens of action, or silently complicit with the wrong side of history. To be more than the country our slave-owning founding fathers imagined, or become that which we defeated in World War II. On November 9th, I woke up to a new world. I've been looking for answers to a lot of questions, not unlike those ever since. This show, The Undiscovered Country, is my attempt to find some answers. I'm not a reporter on this show. I'm a citizen of the United States looking for the dream that is America. I'm a man who could afford to understand things a little better than I do. I expect the form of this show to grow and change as we all do. Along the way, I hope to explore the U.S. Constitution in all its complexity, the never-ending drug war and the many threads that have come off of it, a White House cabinet that looks to be the most inept, corrupt, ill-prepared, and potentially damaging in U.S. history. And we'll explore the multiple wars our country is fighting. And through all this, hopefully, we will find the name of action, together. In my years working as a reporter specializing in performance-enhancing drugs and combat sports, it took me time to figure out the right questions to ask. I expect this show to follow a similar path. This first interview is the beginning of my public search for the right political and social questions to ask. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Jesse Stout. He's a local lawyer and activist. We met briefly years ago, but something he said back then, in a sense, got me on this journey. The subject of mass incarceration, a byproduct of this country's law and order policies and commitment to the 40-year drug war, had come up, and Jesse mentioned getting rid of that. Getting rid of mass incarceration, I asked. Incarceration as a whole, he replied. The concept of no incarceration never occurred to me, and honestly kind of blew my mind. I was on my way out the door when he said it, so I couldn't follow up, and I hadn't found the right moment to broach the subject again until this past week when he agreed to sit down with me and be interviewed. Welcome to the Undiscovered Country.
Well, people seem to confuse. I've been noticing this and realizing this. We needed change in our government. Like I came from being an independent who didn't vote for Obama either time, never voted for Bill Clinton. I voted for Ross Perot. In fact, not the second time, the first time, but was the kind of guy. My dad's Democrat. I have a rear admiral for an uncle. Well, he's passed now, but he was head of the Seabees, like as right wing as you could get. Worked, for several presidents. Worked in the Pentagon. So I've got that pull, but I've always been very independent. But what I've noticed is that people confuse the idea that the country is really corrupt and the government's really corrupt and we need to fix that with Donald Trump being the solution to that, or with Hillary Clinton not being the solution to that problem. And the president, that's not what the president does. That's not their job to clean up the government. And so I don't know if you've
noticed
that.
They are the government. They're not cleaning up the government. No.
Right, yeah. Right. It's
They could help, maybe, but we should not entrust the leadership of policing themselves with
them. They're not a savior.
No. Yeah.
That's not their position.
One time I was, I forget, the end of high school or early college, I was voting for the first time. This is in the state of New Jersey. And even though New Jersey is usually a Democratic state, I lived in a very Republican county in New Jersey. And so my first election ever, I went to vote. And, you know, the top of the ballot, very exciting. And then I learned for the first time there's all this down-ballot stuff that you don't see ads for on TV. And towards the very bottom of my ballot, I'm asked to vote for people for the Democratic County Committee. And there was no one running because nobody wanted to work for Democratic leadership in this county. And I was moving away around that time, go off to college. And so I felt a somewhat flippant reaction and decided to write in my parents. And they both won with 1 out of 1 votes and were made to serve terms on Democratic Party.
Really?
My dad spent the whole time trying to get out of it. And my mom actually went to some meetings, donated some money. And so I felt it was like a productive little...
That's funny. They ran unopposed, basically.
Yeah.
They didn't even know it.
Well, they didn't really run so much as...
They got elected. Yes. Yeah. Was that your first time kind of being involved in seeing, like, change being possible just by taking an action? Is that what you took out of that?
I guess. Also in high school, I did stuff with, you know, Amnesty International.
Okay.
Which is a group that sends handwritten letters to people who are incarcerated, usually in foreign countries and usually for acts of conscience or political prisoners.
Right, right.
And so they don't usually take what I think of as controversial stands, but it is a very, like, compassionate humanitarian group just send mail, like fan mail or personal mail, to people who kind of have nothing better to do than read their mail. And that was probably the first time I thought about incarceration, I think.
Yeah, I remember I went to a Human Rights Now, I think it was put on by Amnesty International, concert out here at the Oakland Coliseum, like Peter Gabriel, Sting, nice. Like all these people. It's one of my first concerts as a young teen. But I remember my brother had this book, Jerry, and that's when I became aware of them. It was called How to Commit Suicide in South Africa. Mm. And it was during when it was still an apartheid state, and Mandela was still... probably 15 years from getting out, maybe more. And this was like around the time the Sun City, you know, the bands got together and did the Sun City album. And that's when I first kind of realized that. And that's when I remember first hearing about Amnesty International. So did you write letters?
Yeah, I mean, just like after school, like an hour a week, just writing a couple of letters, trying to let people know, like, there's people out there who care.
Yeah.
I wasn't like any kind of leader at that time, but... definitely got me thinking about how terrible it would be to be incarcerated, yeah.
So where does that lead you next from there?
You were saying, what do I do? Okay, so I got involved in community activism when I was a young person, probably 18. I started college, and I went to all these different... like student organizations that accorded with my conscience, like the Green Party and the Socialists and the ACLU, and I mentioned Amnesty International, and even the Democrats sometimes. And most of them kind of felt like we, the 18-year-olds, are not going to make a big difference in the world.
Yeah.
But there was one, I went to the first ever meeting of my school's chapter of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, SSDP.
Yeah.
And this guy who cared a lot about drug policy, was about to graduate from our college, and he felt like he could help by getting people together to talk about it. And so a half dozen of us sat around a table being like, what could we do for drug policy? And it was very much like a not formed agenda. We sat down meeting one, like planning meeting, like we're going to educate ourselves over the next couple of weeks. We're going to set some goals.
Right, right.
And so we learned about drug policy reform together and learned a little bit about the state of play in the movement and set some goals. Our first year on our college campus, we were going to get the cops out of the dorms because they were wasting their time taking away our bongs instead of go stopping robberies like cops are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And that was very successful. We set a long-term goal that before we graduated, we were going to pass a medical marijuana law in the state of Rhode Island. And at that time, there were only a few states that had medical marijuana laws, so yeah. It was still a somewhat radical concept. And through doing this work, I met a woman who had been recommended marijuana by her physician because she was suffering terrible pain and spasms from multiple sclerosis and would not take his recommendation, would not use marijuana because then she could go to jail and not be allowed to raise her children anymore. It was just wow. The most egregious harm I'd personally encountered at that time in my life. Yeah. The worst social injustice I was seeing with my own eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And so I ended up spending a lot of time on the issue while I was a student, probably a lot more time on drug policy reform than I did on academics or really anything else. And we were very successful. We raised a lot of grant money to hire lobbyists and started a nonprofit, RIPAC, the Rhode Island Patient Advocacy Coalition.
Yeah.
And did a lot of educational work all over the state, especially targeting swing legislators to, sure enough, pass a medical marijuana law during our last year as students. And I very much still remember after the governor vetoed our law, we came back during my last winter break to ultimately successfully argue for an override of a gubernatorial veto, which was pretty rare at that time in our state. And so we passed medical marijuana law. We were the 11th state in 2006. And then that May, when I graduated from college, that same month, the Rhode Island Department of Health sent out these first handful of patient cards where people, including my friend and some other people who had testified for the law, had got this card in the mail and then called me up saying things like, where do I get marijuana? Or even, how do you use marijuana? And I just, like, had this realization in talking with my friends from SSDP and RIPAC who had worked on this law with me that we had only just begun. I mean, not only were people not fully educated yet, but we had yet to begin the education of the public and the organizing to implement the law, let alone eventually organizing to improve the law in various ways.
Right, right.
Since at that time, there was no safe access to medical marijuana like there is in dispensaries in now 20-something states.
Right.
People were just literally expected to grow it themselves. And so that took another 3 years or so.
And the quality back east wasn't exactly California. Indeed.
Right? I mean, you can just imagine me, 21, get a half dozen seriously ill people together in a room, like, yeah. Google how to grow marijuana. Like, not quality education, no.
No, yeah.
And so I became the executive director of our new nonprofit, RIPAC, and raised a bunch of money for staff and more lobbyists. And over the course of several years, we were able to pass several amendments to the medical marijuana law we created, where patients would now be able to go to a store to buy marijuana like other medicines. And it took a lot of time. Considering how the concept no longer seems radical, it seems to have taken an inordinate amount of effort. in that we had to do all this organizing to get people together and then find that people had literally never talked about marijuana in any public forum because it had been illegal for their entire lives.
Right.
And so that was a big difference for people who were dying of serious illnesses. And then we had to do a lot of education of professionals, tried to trainings for police departments and the nurses and lawyers and the doctors, grand rounds at the hospital and the social workers and, of course, the legislators and the media.
Because you've got, not just, there's, 40 years of no research, but also 40 years of misinformation, disinformation.
Yeah, no domestic research at all. And so then we had quite a uphill battle to convince people of the necessity, but we were ultimately successful in mobilizing hundreds, eventually thousands of people to come to meetings or talk to the legislators or donate. And so now Rhode Island does have a successful medical marijuana program. And during the course of this organizing, I had a lot of one-on-one type education opportunities for me to learn what people are going through and for them to learn about their legal rights. And in particular, I remember one fellow came to my office one day, a patient who had been growing medical cannabis for himself, but also our law allowed him to appoint a caregiver to grow it for him too. And so he asked me, if me and my caregiver each grow our allotment of a dozen plants in the same basement together, is that allowed? And I said, oh yeah, we just wrote it has to be indoors. That seems fine.
Yeah.
And so he's like, what if the police show up and it looks like we have too many plants? You know, as if it was one person's plants, that's too many. And I was like, you would have to show at trial that it wasn't. You would have a criminal defense lawyer explain it to the court. And so he asked me, well, can you do that for me? Can you show up in court? Since you wrote parts of this law, you would be a great source of statutory interpretation here.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, I was unable to do that. I had to apologize that I lacked that piece of paper. I could help him to liaise with the media or the legislature or these various professions, but I was not allowed to go to court for him. And it really bothered me. That I couldn't help in this one particular way. It seems so arbitrary.
Yeah.
And around the same time...
It's just because you weren't a lawyer?
Yeah, yeah. What a stupid rule.
Yeah.
That I can't be the person arguing for him in court, even if I'm the one who knows best.
Right, right.
And so around this time, also, it had occurred to me that even though it was great we were passing this medical marijuana law, where this very narrow slice of the population would not suffer the harm of incarceration for their medical use of cannabis. At the same time, I was realizing that the same logic holds true for other drug crimes. That it's stupid to incarcerate people for adult use of cannabis or really any other controlled substance because we do them the harm of incarceration at great cost to society,
right,
with our scarce, limited resources that could go to helpful things like education or healthcare. And so by putting drug users in jail, we were harming both them by incarcerating them and ourselves by spending, or I would argue wasting, those scarce resources, the tax dollars that would go to social services. And the more I thought about it, I came to the realization that I feel the same about the entire criminal justice system. That the rationale for incarceration, that of specific deterrence to prevent this person from committing crimes and general deterrence to convince other people not to commit crimes preemptively, doesn't outweigh the great cost where we spend all these billions of dollars at the local, state, and federal level to lock people up and hurt them without helping ourselves very much at all.
Yeah.
So I had come to the conclusion both that I wanted to be able to defend people in criminal court and that we ought to abolish prisons. And through drug policy reform organizing and conferences, I had come into contact with a lot of other people who had worked on legalizing various illegal things.
Yeah.
For example, psychedelic drugs, currently illegal for the most part, also have medical utility and ought to be legal, as well as many lawyers from whom I learned that law school is difficult, expensive, tedious, and a huge opportunity cost, but still worth it to many people.
Yeah.
And so I decided to go to law school. I ended up going to UC Hastings, a couple blocks that way,
yeah,
and studying criminal defense. And I worked for a bunch of different public defense organizations, the Public Defenders of San Diego and San Francisco and Marin, and did some other stuff during school. National Lawyers Guild, I don't know if you're familiar with NLG, is a group that does a lot of organizing, community work among lawyers, but also does political support for protests, legal support for demonstrations, where people who are being arrested by the police for their political views can get basically free representation through this organization. And I was really invested in making it so that fewer people would go to jail. And then my last semester of law school, I also interned for the state legislature up in Sacramento. I moved up there for about 4 months and worked for the Assembly's Public Safety Committee, then chaired by, at that time, our State Assembly member, Tom Amiano. And he, my boss, Tom, asked me to work on an analysis of a bill he was doing to regulate medical cannabis in California. At that time, though there were thousands of marijuana stores in California, there were no state rules for how they should operate. And so he had this great bill, and I wrote up what it would do, and it didn't make it out of committee. And I feel like I learned a lesson about how even if I was going to help people one at a time to get out of jail or stay out of jail, there would still be these policy opportunities to affect a wider swath of the population.
Right.
So that's where I was at when I graduated law school, started practicing criminal defense, started representing people arrested at protests or especially for medical cannabis, going to California state courts to argue that people should not go to jail, even though our medical marijuana laws at that time were so vague, so broad, as to be utterly confusing to a judge, let alone a prosecutor, that we should err on the side of not putting people in jail for marijuana. And it only took me really a few months, basically, of doing this to come to the conclusion that this would not be for me. That individual representation of people accused of crimes was not going to be the way that I could exert the most positive pressure on our overall political system. Because every time I went to the podium with a client, even if I was totally successful and they were going to get off scot-free, there would still be 1,000 more people go to jail behind my back that same day. And
that's soul-crushing.
Totally. So I couldn't do it anymore. So I started looking for other lines of work and was looking back to do policy work in criminal justice reform again.
Yeah.
In drug policy reform or ideally something broader. And another bill I'd analyzed in my role as an intern in Sacramento was a bill to prohibit the shackling of pregnant prisoners. In other words, women who are currently already pregnant, who have yet to give birth, who are in our state prisons, meaning either they were incarcerated while pregnant or they were raped by a guard, who are currently pregnant, being handcuffed behind their back or shackled around the waist or even at the ankles.
Because you get, yeah.
Which most countries and humans would call torture, was still legal in California. This is 2012.
Wow.
And so, of course, I wrote that this is a great bill and we should pass it. And actually, it did pass. But that was not the first attempt of the organization that it sponsored. It had been a many years campaign. And so this year, I had written about it and it passed. And I ended up getting a job interview with that organization. LSPC stands for Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. And LSPC had at that time already been working for 35 years, to provide better legal services for Californian family members who were incarcerated.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of sad stories around the office. People going to prison for decades,
yeah,
or life, or even being executed. And they had focused on the rights of family members and supported loved ones on the outside and the inside for decades, you know, like before I was born.
Yeah.
And at this job interview, they were impressed that I had written the analysis on their bill of the past.
Nice.
And so I became the policy director of LSPC. And this is like a little bit before, like a year before, after I graduated, I guess.
Okay.
And then I went to work as basically the state lobbyist for this prison abolition group, going to Sacramento to argue for eliminating crimes and shortening sentences, and especially the group's hallmark for better civil rights following incarceration. LSPC is very invested in the concept of leadership by and for formerly incarcerated people. Yeah. That people who are have been incarcerated ought to be the ones who know best about criminal justice and criminal justice reform. And the executive director is formerly incarcerated, as are most of the staff and board.
Is that right?
And so there's like formerly incarcerated organizers and there's attorneys. And they have an office just like two blocks down here on Market. And so through that work, over several years, I learned a lot about the state of play of prison abolition work in the Bay Area and California, nationally and a little bit internationally. And so I worked on various state legislation, including legislation to remove fees for juvenile expungements.
Yeah.
And worked on various litigation, including a lawsuit to restore the voting rights of people who are on post-release community supervision, tens of thousands of people, and also worked on local lobbying besides state lobbying. So the group's flagship campaign of LSPC is a movement called Ban the Box, which is a concept probably a dozen years old now, where we think that people who are filling out some kind of application or form telling somebody about themselves, mm-hmm, should not be asked a checkbox, have you been convicted of a crime, or have you been convicted of a felony, or have you been arrested? Because none of these yes-no checkbox questions will ever give you a picture of who someone is and whether they'd be a good employee or tenant or insuree or foster parent. They'll only tell you one thing about them and always necessarily be taken in inappropriate context.
Right.
And so we, LSPC, work to pass not only state legislation for forbidding this practice in public employment, but also here in San Francisco successfully local legislation that now forbids this checkbox in all employment as well as public housing.
And that's passed?
2014, yes.
Is that right? I did not know that.
I've got hella plaques in there.
That's awesome.
And so I... Oh, please.
Well, I mean, so that's for all crimes?
There are, unfortunately, some carve-outs, some exceptions, even here in the San Francisco law, where different categories of crimes can be asked out for some number of years, yeah, depending on whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor, or violent or nonviolent.
Yeah.
But at least in San Francisco, there are no crimes that one can ask about forever, so long as they're irrelevant to the job qualifications. We have the three R's policy, where depending on the recency of the crime and the relevance, the relatedness to the job qualifications. So, for example, that if someone's being offered a job applying with children, then if they have some kind of like child pornography conviction, then the employer can still consider that.
Let me ask you this about just kind of connecting the two things of the disenfranchisement of criminals or people that have been arrested. What are the rules across the board? How do you lose your right to vote? Does it have to be a felony and you can no longer vote? Is it a violent crime? How does that happen? And are you guys are obviously working to reverse that or to remedy that?
Yeah, so I held this job from 2013 to 2015, about 2.5 years, and it's definitely one of the things I feel most passionately about from that work, because it seems to me that as long as we continue to have a democracy where these decisions are made based on elections, the underlying fundamental premise that the electorate represents the decisions to be made can only be affected if we have a representative electorate, of course. So it's also complicated, your question, because it's different in so many different jurisdictions where across the country, different states have different laws about when or even whether you can vote again. Famously, in Florida, you need a personal permission from the governor himself to be able to vote again if you've been convicted of, I think, any felony or serious misdemeanor, so that people show up once a year to this circus where the governor presides from a dais, granting and denying hundreds of petitions, and then, of course, thousands more people just don't get to the front of the line. So here in California, to answer your question, you cannot vote if you're in prison. In other words, if you're currently serving a sentence for a felony in a state prison, or if you're still on parole following a state felony conviction. So that means that people who are in jail can vote, and people who are on probation, with or without a jail sentence, can also vote. And this is very confusing, obviously, for the tens of thousands of people who have heard, just as you, I think, and I have heard many times, that if you've been convicted of something or other, you can't vote anymore.
Yeah.
And it turns out that there's a finer distinction to be made, in California law at least, about whether this leads to a temporary disenfranchisement. And in fact, no one is permanently disenfranchised.
Oh, well, thank you for busting that, man. Well, there's something like, we're seeing the end of prohibition with weed, with cannabis, the mm-hmm. preferred term. And it was something that I was watching the documentary Ken Burns did about prohibition, and how people that went to jail for selling alcohol, when prohibition was over, their records didn't get expunged. And there was a lot of people that made a lot of money by getting into the liquor business at the right time, maybe just before
it ended. The Kennedy family, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we're starting to see that with marijuana, as it's going to be a multi-billion-dollar industry. It already is, and yet you've got a lot of people that went to jail for a long time for not that much weed. How do we fix that problem?
I have a lot to say about that. it's fantastic that we're finally seeing whole U.S. states pass laws ending cannabis prohibition once and for all. And it's not only, within our lifetime, but within this very decade, we've seen the first now 8 states plus the District of Columbia completely eliminate penalties for adults possessing small amounts of cannabis, which even 20 years ago, within our lifetime, seemed epic eons or eras from now away still.
Yeah.
And so I think it's great progress, for sure. That being said, I have a couple different professional roles right now. My main job, I do corporate law for cannabis companies. Our law firm is called Greenbridge Corporate Counsel, and we provide business law, transactional matters for clients who either are entering or have created a company in the cannabis space. So okay. We have attorneys in Washington, Colorado, and Hawaii, I think soon to be Oregon as well, and we help people with both generic corporate tasks like choosing the form of entity or forming their corporation or drafting contracts or issuing securities, debt, equity, but also cannabis-specific tasks like navigating the conflicting laws and regulations at the state, local, or federal level.
Yeah.
And besides that, I also have a side gig doing recruiting in the cannabis space, where cannabis companies come to us, THC staffing group, with particular employee needs. We want to hire a specialized employee with such and such background.
Yeah.
Can you help us find this person? So we do like national searches to find people who are qualified for this space. And every time I have a call with a candidate to figure out whether someone would be a good fit for a particular client's job, I start the conversation by asking them whether they see the racial justice implications of cannabis legalization. Because to me, the end of prohibition is a chance to undermine racism in our country and the disparate societal impact of prohibition, where people have been treated differently for decades, going on, well, just over a century now,
yeah,
of drug prohibition in this country, based on not only their socioeconomic level, but also simply their race or ethnicity, where people have been targeted by law enforcement and not only arrested, not only convicted, but sentenced at much greater rates for much longer times. And this has had a disparate impact over now generations, such that we've re-entrenched all of the harms of capitalism based on this arbitrary birth characteristic that have caused people to suffer for no rationale. And so I see the end of cannabis prohibition, where people are able to make money, businesses, out of this new economic opportunity, as a chance to undo at least some amount of that harm. Where if we're going to have eventually equity in new companies and immediately employment opportunities for new job candidates, that these opportunities ought to be able to be a way to create capital opportunities in communities that have been harmed by the war on drugs.
Yeah.
And so I want to see these jobs go to women and people of color, because that, to me, is the best way to take advantage of the opportunity of ending prohibition, where we're not only undoing the social harm of future incarceration, but also creating future social benefit for the economy, and specifically people who have been disadvantaged in our economy. But as you pointed out, there's still this problem of criminal records for people, right, in the short term, where even if 3 generations from now there will be no one with a cannabis conviction, right now, here today, tens of thousands of people here in the Bay Area, hundreds of thousands of people in California, and millions of people across the country have been arrested for cannabis crimes, even though we as a society are now waking up to the argument that organizers have been making for years that this shouldn't have been illegal in the first place. That it was a racist, right, policy, and now that we're getting rid of it, what are we going to do to fix those harms? So in the first couple states to legalize cannabis, in Colorado and Washington, there wasn't really anything directly baked into law to fix this. There continued to be people discriminated against in employment and housing and every other area of life based on the fact that they were convicted of something that is now totally legal.
Yeah.
Since then, we had Oregon pass their initiative and the legislature added an expungement provision where now in Oregon it is possible to remove from your record a crime that is now a legal activity. And since then, you know, this past November, 2 months ago, we had 4 more states pass these cannabis legalization initiatives. And in Massachusetts and also in California, we have now provided for processes to undo this particular harm of prohibition, where now in California, you can fill out a simple form, couple checkboxes, you send in to the court that sentenced you, and if you were convicted of something that is indeed legal now, you're going to be able to get that dismissed from your record actually pretty easily, considering how complicated California law is, relatively simply. And most people will be able to at least figure out the basics without a lawyer. If the prosecutor challenges you, then maybe you do need a lawyer, but at least to get the process started, pretty simple procedure. And I'm really happy that Californians will be able to undo this harm, this stigma, and this form of discrimination be able to tell employers or landlords with a straight face that they do not have a conviction.
Right.
Because their only conviction was something that is now a legal activity.
Somebody that was a defense attorney, I rewatched the 13th last night. My wife hadn't seen it, so we watched it. And I'm stunned by the Nixon's former the domestic policy advisor, is it Ehrlichman, mm-hmm. that said straight up, you know, did we know that we were lying about this, creating this racist law where we couldn't outlaw being a hippie, we couldn't outlaw being a black person, so we criminalized drugs and we assigned them, you know, we attached them to these groups and we ruined lives for 40 years. And we knew what we were doing. How come nobody has not taken that and used that as a way to overturn law? I mean, what is the basis for weed being illegal?
Well, there are many organizations, drug policy nonprofits, others who have tried to make the argument you're espousing that because drug prohibition is and always has been racist, we should get rid of it. But ultimately, that has not taken steam with the legislatures across the country, that people have not chosen, with few exceptions, have not chosen to vote for ending cannabis prohibition when they hear that it's racist. And I will say that there are exceptions, like, for example, in the District of Columbia in D.C., when they ran their legalization initiative a couple of years ago, they really based the whole campaign around the fact that prohibiting marijuana is a racist idea. And they were very successful, passed by a wide margin.
Yeah.
But that being said, I think the argument that drug prohibition should be changed because it's racist goes back much farther. I mean, we had our first American drug prohibition here in San Francisco at the local level when the Board of Supervisors realized that the best way to prevent Chinese people from taking over the laundry business was to criminalize something that Chinese people were doing and other people weren't. So Chinese American people who were using opium or visiting opium dens mm-hmm. became criminal under city law here in San Francisco.
Yep.
When that was just not a thing anywhere else in the country. When no one had thought to criminalize people based on what they were putting in their bodies. And then
it's a war on consciousness.
Yes, absolutely. A deprivation of cognitive liberty where there had been none before. And over the next few decades following, we had the movement in the southern part of the country, especially Texas, to try and prevent Mexican and Mexican-American migrant workers from taking jobs that would have gone to Caucasian farmhands and ranchers. And the thing that they had in common was that they smoked marijuana. And so it was possible to prevent them from taking our jobs,
right,
from gaining economic power, by prohibiting something with no other basis, no rational basis. And then following, when we get closer to the World War area, we had the movement that ultimately resulted in the predecessor to the United Nations passing treaty agreements where U.S. diplomats, including Harry Anslinger, argued that these drugs that most of these politicians had never heard of before, like, what even is marijuana? I've never heard of that. You would never identify that with the hemp in your medicine cabinet.
Right.
Are somehow bad for white people or women or children or something. And a lot of diplomats, international and domestic, signed on to treaties and then ultimately federal laws preventing activities that they didn't know anything about. Then in the 30s, we had the first Marijuana Tax Act, federal law that the American Medical Association opposed, saying that it would be illegal to have or sell marijuana without a tax stamp from the government, that if the government doesn't print any stamps, it's just going to be illegal. And then fast forward to the 1960s, the new social war on marijuana,
right,
and the identification of undesirable people like the hippies with the fact that they were using this drug, and we could put them in jail, get them out of the sight of our middle class by criminalizing them. And it was a new concept to most people because marijuana wasn't technically illegal until the Controlled Substances Act. We had the 1970 Declaration of the War on Drugs by Nixon, and then ultimately the mandatory minimums under the Reagan administration under the 80s, and then absolutely much harsher penalties under the Clinton administration of the 90s.
Yeah, there's a pure explosion. It's kind of crazy. I was born in 73, and to think that in my lifetime, those two major events kind of feed each other. The war on drugs begins in 71, 70, right in there, and then mass incarceration really kicks it up a notch in the Clinton years, in the 90s. And now you've got, what, 2 million, over 2 million people in prison. Something that made me think of, because it's in a sense saying reparations. It's almost kind of like Indian casinos. Maybe we can try to get these guys some millions of dollars somehow, get them some power. But like people that oppose affirmative action and call it a racist law against white people, wouldn't they push back against your idea? And what would the argument against that be? I've always thought racism is about power. It's hard for people of color and disenfranchised people to be racist.
Yeah, that one goes real deep. I mean, I could talk about that on a lot of levels. You should check out, I'm doing a webinar. It's next Tuesday the 24th at noon, all about racial discrimination in business licensing in the cannabis industry.
That's a rabbit hole.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I guess I don't believe in whatever reverse racism or reverse affirmative action. I mean, it's, to me, people who say that are fundamentally misconstruing. I mean, there's a difference between social equity and social equality, that if there are white people out there who say we should all be equal, we should only provide equal social benefits or equal financial incentives, that doesn't recognize the currently disparate societal positions of different groups of people. If one community is worse off than another, then equality will not help because they're not equal. Treating them the same will never ultimately help people to have equal rights or equal capital power. So instead, pursuing social equity, where we're trying to treat people differently on purpose in order to help people who need it more, is the way to go. That's what social justice means to me.
Right.
And that this example of eliminating drug prohibition is a great opportunity to showcase that people who have less capital, less jobs, or less good housing, or less good environmental conditions, or less good civil rights, or even family unity, are more deserving in the short term of the benefit of prospective legislation. And so I would encourage social policies and local and state laws that actually look to people disenfranchised by drug prohibition as those to whom the benefits should accrue most immediately.
Okay. Yeah. Good answer. The idea of no incarceration, let's just go down that road and we can kind of head towards wrap up. What does that look like? And when you talk about, you know, when you're talking about eliminating laws, you're talking about unnecessary laws like drug laws. I'm for the decriminalization of the whole thing. But what about murderers? What about violent criminals? What do you do with them in terms of incarceration or not incarcerating them?
Well, first, on a philosophical tangent here, on semiotics or linguistics, I wouldn't use the word murderer because to me it buys into a flawed premise, a false assumption that it is possible to reduce a person to be reflected by a single action. When I think that people are made up of diverse thoughts and perspectives and feelings and actions are the sum of their behaviors and not ever going to be accurately displayed based on one thing that they may or may not have done ever. And so I might talk about a person who's been convicted of murder, but I wouldn't talk about a murderer because I think that it doesn't really reflect that person's humanity. It only reflects the worst thing they've ever done in their life. And to me, everyone retains their dignity as a human being regardless of whether they've been adjudicated in a court. So I would never say felon, perhaps person who's been convicted of a felony, or I would never say convict. I might say someone who has a conviction history. Because to me, this kind of person-first language is going to emphasize the philosophical underpinning that, to me, assumes human dignity, whereas mass incarceration has disregarded it. But to get to what you're actually asking
about... That's great, though. That's great. I do the same with cannabis. I don't say...
Oh, yeah. And that's just a plant. This is like human beings. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, no, that's great.
And so, to me, any alternative has to recognize not only the harm that we're undoing, but the benefit that we're conferring, that we're going to treat people as human beings now instead of warehousing them to die alone. And it's great that we're going to undo the waste, but also this is a real opportunity to improve social justice, to create greater social and economic equity. That for anyone who does something that we as a society disapprove of, there will always be a more appropriate response than incarcerating them. For instance, we as a society have already decided that if you run a red light, we should send you a ticket. In other words, we should charge you money, not put you in jail. We've realized collectively from the get-go that it will not help to put that person in jail. It might specifically deter them. In other words, during that time that they're in jail, they might be prevented physically from running a red light here on the streets. But we know that that's an irrational response, that it's too heavy-handed. And it might have some benefit towards general deterrence. We might have fewer people running a red light if there are more people in jail for running a red light. But we know better that that's not going to make the world a better place. So instead we treat it differently. And by, to me, logical extension, I feel that way about everything else that society currently criminally prohibits. That if someone's convicted of a property crime, that probably means that they had some reason to do that in their own mind that we could address by helping them instead of hurting them. And this is better for both the social policy of improving their lives as well as the economic policy that helping them will be cheaper than incarcerating them anyway. At Hastings, there's Professor Hadar Avaram, who has a whole book about this philosophy I'd encourage, but to answer the question, the idea is here that if someone's going to be incarcerated under the status quo, there will always be something we can do to help them instead. If someone's committing a crime because they have a mental illness, then we can offer them mental health services or behavioral health services rather than wasting a greater amount of money on causing them to suffer by incarcerating them. And the arguments for deterrence, to me, are valid arguments, but just lesser value than the opportunity to actually help someone. Whereas the argument for retribution simply does not hold any water at all. That we should punish someone for their own sake on some moral grounds has never made sense to me, because the idea that punishment is of any intrinsic value assumes that it does some good, and I don't see that.
Like killing Dylann Roof at this point. Well, you've already got him. He's already off the street.
There are many ways to prevent him from doing that again that do not involve taking human life. That he clearly has serious mental health problems that have not been treated. If he thought it was okay, let alone good, to kill people, let alone a bunch of people, for any reason, then he needs serious help from a doctor, maybe even a bunch of doctors. No kidding.
Yeah.
And that we could provide those services, and he may or may not become a good person, but at least we wouldn't have to kill someone. I mean, leaving alone the death penalty is such a great expense to the state. The social value of murder, to me, is none, is negative, actually.
It does damage.
Yes, it does great harm, not only to him, the ultimate harm, but also to all of us, by implying that it's okay to kill someone, ever.
Right. No, I've kind of gone back and forth on it, but I voted against it, you know, in this last election. And yeah, I mean, isn't it that a society is judged by how it treats the worst of us, not the best?
And so in other countries besides ours, there are vastly differing approaches to criminal justice and incarceration. There are countries like China and Indonesia who will kill people by firing squad for much lesser offenses for which one might be incarcerated and not killed here in this country. And by contrast, there are countries, for example, in Northern Europe where people will be sentenced to jail for only the most heinous societally disapproved crimes. That most crimes are treated as a financial matter or as a matter deserving of some social service like healthcare or education or community service opportunities rather than incarceration. That someone who might go to jail for years in this country will go to jail for months in Scandinavia. Someone who might be executed in this country still has a maximum sentence in Norway or Sweden or Finland of 10 or 20 years and will not spend their whole life in prison. That everyone will be released and will receive social services before and after their release to support their reentry.
Because that's the big thing, too, is that when a guy gets out, there's not a lot of options for him.
And increasingly in this country, when a woman gets out, there are even fewer options. Yes.
Yeah. What is the recidivism?
Recidivism.
Thank you. Rate in general. I mean, it's pretty high, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
suffice to say, it's enormous. Say. Yes.
Yeah. So heading into a Trump administration, I mean, it seemed like things were kind of bending towards the end of the drug war. And yet we're kind of probably going back. Do you think we're going to be turning back the clock, or is it too early to tell?
I think some members of the Trump administration, even ones who are outwardly explicitly racist, are actually primarily motivated by economic power and will do whatever they find to be most profitable for themselves and people like them, their family members or people of the same racial group or people of the same economic class. And so to the extent that incarceration is profitable for some people and further the extent that that group overlaps with the incoming administration, that it'll increase. And there will be some counterbalancing efforts of us and the social justice movement to prevent that, and that the economic incentives will continue to win out in the short term, as has usually, though not always, been in the case in the country. And while here we are speaking auspiciously on Martin Luther King Day, that the arc of history will bend toward justice. These coming 4 to 8 years of the Trump administration,
maybe 12,
maybe on the upswing of that arc.
Yeah,
hard to say. We'll see. Of course, during the Obama administration, the federal government decided not to continue contracts with private companies that offer the service of incarceration,
like federal CCA prisoners and GeoCorp.
That those companies took significant financial hits on their stock price. For the ones that are publicly traded, at least, because the Obama administration decided not to do business with them anymore. And so I think one indicator of the approach taken by Trump Department of Justice and the Trump administration will be whether that policy stands, since it is a unilaterally executive decision.
Yeah, I'm curious. I heard that their stocks went up on election night. that CCA Indeed. And GeoCorp and I think Lockheed Martin also did very well in Defense Company. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see. And this last thing, as part of the show, what I'd like to do is bring people on like yourself that know more about the stuff that I'm interested in and kind of show me where the icebergs are and show me as much of it as they can. But to leave us with an action, something that the people listening and myself can do, people that aren't lawyers but that want to, you know, be a force for good and change in the world, what can we do? How do we get involved?
The first part, yeah, I'm definitely happy to find you a bunch of people to talk to. I know a lot of people who'd be happy to explain things, especially with such a large audience. That's excellent. Yeah. As far as how to help, I think that even before political activism for a particular piece of legislation or a particular movement, there's community organizing of your own neighborhood, that it's important to know your neighbors and talk to them about what's important to you, including your political views. That too often people have a neighborhood association or a block party where it's considered rude to talk about politics because people think that it's not worth risking their immediate social relationships over what's really important to them. And that's backwards to me. And I think that people should always work to become comfortable with taking the interpersonal risk of explaining your values. And beyond that, once you've organized your community, at least to the extent of talking to your friends and family about how you feel about something so important as personal liberty, that next up is talking to groups who explicitly organize to change policies relating to what you care about, whether that's civil liberties or criminal justice. There's already organizations in every jurisdiction, and now with the advent of the internet, you can just go on Google and find people to talk to. And so, for instance, here in California, there's a great group, CURB, Californians United for a Responsible Budget, that lobbies the state legislature to spend less money on incarceration, to close prisons, and reallocate that funding towards more just solutions for our society, like healthcare and education.
Nice.
And CURB's website, curbprisonspending.org, has a list of dozens of member organizations who have endorsed these principles, where all up and down the state, people from the labor movement, the environmental movement, the student movement, of course the criminal justice reform movement, yeah, the drug policy movement, have all signed on saying that they agree and want to support this. So whether that takes the form of going to organizing meetings or showing up to protests and rallies and demonstrations or even just donating, there's always something you can do. I mean, now with, again, the internet, you can literally just go on somebody's website and send them money with your credit card.
Yeah,
and
that helps.
Organizations on the state, local, and national level will always be happier to have you as a monthly donor who actually reads their newsletter, stays engaged, and has the opportunity to at least click on electronic-type, petition-type actions, even if you don't additionally continue to donate or additionally go to events and protests and stay engaged with campaigns. For people here in San Francisco, you may or may not know there's the jail fight that's going on through the Board of Supervisors right now. About 5 years ago, the state government passed a law called Realignment, saying that many people who had previously been incarcerated in state prisons in California would now instead be incarcerated in local jails in the county jail system. And in order to make this politically and economically feasible, the governor reallocated lots of money for jail construction so that counties would be able to increase their capacity for incarceration. And many counties in California, in fact, the majority of counties now, have already at least approved plans, if not actually built jails, since this law 5 years ago. Here in San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors did decide to pursue plans, hired architects, devoted thousands of city employee hours to figuring out what the new jail is going to look like. It's politically convenient because the old jail is seismically unsound, needs to be torn down anyway, so they're just like, oh, we'll just build a bigger jail. And then criminal justice organizers, the community at large, spoke out, diverse people, saying that that is both wasteful and unjust. Then the sheriff came back with a plan. Let's build a smaller jail. We'll build a new jail, but it won't be as big. That makes it okay, right? And so we're not replacing the entire jail system. San Francisco also owns jails down in San Mateo County. Yeah. They're just talking about replacing the one oldest jail on Bryant Street, at 50 Bryant.
Yeah.
And so the Board of Supervisors scheduled a vote to apply for a state grant for this state money to build this jail. And many people, including myself, showed up, talked to them in advance, lobbied saying that this is going to be a bad use of funds because incarceration does not help San Franciscans. It can only hurt us. Even people who have serious mental health problems and should be immediately kept away from other people because they're a physical risk of danger and violence will not be served by incarceration. Much better to increase mental health services in San Francisco and offer better social services so that people have more job opportunities, so that people have access to prescription medications, so that people have access to inpatient and outpatient hospitalization. And eventually the Board of Supervisors, this is December of 2015, unanimously rejected the state grant money that they were then offered. And so for the past year, we've been continuing to organize to not only not build a jail, now that we've tentatively won that one, but also replace it with something more productive, such as new mental health beds throughout the city's hospital system.
Yeah.
And that's an ongoing fight, because every time there's an election, we have new supervisors who have yet to see the light of the benefits of reducing incarceration, reducing the harms and waste of incarcerating people, and replacing that more justly with social services.
You mean waste, just in terms of money, resources, all of it?
I actually meant people's lives, that we're going to miss our family members while they're locked up for no good reason. But also, yes, the financial waste of the tens of thousands of dollars it costs to incarcerate someone in order to provide guards to harm them and cells to trap them.
And then the appeal system to fight the law that they're in or whatever, all of that stuff. But you're right, I guess I'm going to need some readjustment myself to be thinking first and foremost. But that's politicians, right? Law and order as opposed to health and human services.
Absolutely.
You know, it's one of the things missing from the election for me was, where's the peace candidate? Not even Bernie Sanders felt that way. I voted for him in the primary and did my duty with Hillary, I guess, in the generals. But, well, cool, man. I really appreciate this conversation. You gave me a lot to think about.
And that was Jesse Stout. Thank you so much for spending this hour with me. I hope it was educational. I hope it gave you some things to think about and some things to do, some ways to get involved. So until next week, I'm Gabriel Montoya, and this is The Undiscovered Country.